right, guys. So we're here for our third and final recording at the NRF, the National Retail Federation Big Show. It's been a really great trade show to be at so far. So much conversation about innovation and technology, and it's a really exciting environment to be a part of. We've got the pleasure today to have Lauren Paddleford, and we've also got my colleague Victor on the recording today. We're going to focus a lot about e-commerce, but before we jump into any of the questions, Lauren, I'm going to let you take the floor and kind of introduce yourself. Also talk about Shopify Plus. So Lauren's from Shopify Plus, and very briefly, just give us a bit of a rundown of what you guys do at Shopify Plus. So I'll let you take the floor.
Sure. Well, thanks for inviting me on. So I'm the VP and GM at Shopify, and specifically I run Shopify Plus. I think the easiest way to think about Plus is the enterprise version of Shopify.
Yep.
So we give larger, more complex, scaling companies all the same power, flexibility that entrepreneurs are used to with Shopify, just with more features that help them expand and grow and continue to work. So, you know, we have a broad range of customers. There's a couple thousand that run on Shopify Plus at this point, anywhere from about $1 million in sales a year up to the biggest ones are about $1 billion a year. And some pretty big names, Red Bull, Rebecca Minkoff, Fashion Nova, Bull & Branch, UnTucket, right, all run on Plus at this
fantastic.
Point. So, yeah, it's been a fun 3 years.
Yeah, beautiful. And we've got that Toronto connection in the booth again, and the Canadian connection, just a kind of testament to the retail scene that we have and retail tech scene that we have in Canada at the moment, which is really exciting. Are you a Leafs fan?
No.
No?
Don't care. I don't really watch hockey.
Don't care much of hockey?
No.
Okay.
I don't know. I never really got into it.
No, that's completely fine. I kind of have assimilated to it. So.
Yeah, you're a convert. I'm not going to say that you were born a Leafs fan because you weren't even born a hockey fan. But but absolutely, I think that's one thing that's really cool about Canada in general, but Toronto, the tech scene, there's so much retail innovation going on. There's a lot of companies that are focused in that space, and it's great to be able to be a part of that environment. And we're seeing that here at the show, actually, this year. A lot of Canadians that are up here moving and shaking and talking about what's going on in the industry.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So we'll jump straight into the questions, Lauren. And the first one that we're going to start off with, we've had a little bit of controversy over the last two recordings. So it's the winners and losers. We do it in our normal podcast, but we've had Anne-Marie Stephen from Qualia and your colleague, Simon Rodrigue from Instant Tease. And with our winners and losers, we like to point out who's doing well and who's not doing so well. Anne-Marie and Simon weren't too keen to point out who's not doing so well. Seems everybody wants to stay friends at the NRF and nobody wants to make any enemies. So I'll let you decide how you want to go with it. But what I kind of want to know is who you see really dominating with e-commerce at the moment and maybe who you see who's falling behind with e-commerce.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there's a lot of people doing really interesting things, whether it's online or offline. And I struggle sometimes with the concept of e-commerce. I mean, I get it. Obviously, people have online stores, but the consumer doesn't care, right? The consumers only care about commerce,
yep.
Right? They don't care whether it's online or offline or mobile or social. They just want to buy stuff when they want to buy it, where they want to buy it. And so I think the folks that are doing well have realized this and have stopped trying to make the hard line in the sand difference between their online stores and their offline stores and social media and stuff. They've just said, you know what? We're going to have to give the consumer what they want. It doesn't matter what we want, right? I want everyone to come to my web store. No one cares, right? No one cares about your web store. What they care about is, can they buy something easily when they want to buy it? So I think that's been one of the big shifts. And so I think the people that do well are the ones who recognize that and are experimenting in those areas. And I think you see that in a lot of places, right? So, I mean, Nike is a great example of this blurring of the line of what is shopping, right? So they have these great Nike demo stores that you can't buy anything in. Because their world is like, it's not here. You're not here to buy it. You're here to experience it. And that's such a fascinating concept because humans love experiences. And so you see that. I think there are some really cool online stores, right, that do some cool stuff. But again, I'm impressed by innovators. I'm impressed by people willing to take bets on stuff. So I think, Rebecca Minkoff is a good example of this, is they try everything, right? It's like they literally are, like you put technology out and they're like, yes, let's try that. And a lot of it just doesn't work because it doesn't work, right? But at least you're trying. At least you're innovating. At least you're, and so to me, I respect and I think the winners will be those who have embraced this concept of commerce as experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
It's no one knows the secret sauce yet. No one has any idea what the future of commerce actually is. There's just a whole lot of theory. And it's like, great, let's start experimenting with theory. Conversely, the losers are those right now who are stuck in the past. We've been doing this for X amount of time, and look at how successful it was. Well, that doesn't matter, right? Was is no longer a concept. The whole world changed, you know, 5-6 years ago. And so if you're stuck in what you did 20 years ago, what made you very successful, it's not a thing. Mm-hmm. So continually trying to hold on to what you were. So I'll describe it a different way. There's a lot of sunk cost fallacy running around the industry. Oh, I spent so much money and effort on this thing. We just got to keep trying. If we just spent a little bit more money, if we just throw more people at it, it'll work because it worked 20 years ago. And it's like, that doesn't work, right? You know, in a world where experimentation rules, you've got to experiment. And if it doesn't work, throw it out, move on. Just because it worked 10 years ago doesn't mean it's going to work in the future. So I think the winners will be the ones who experiment. The losers are the ones already, right, who just can't understand the world they are now living in. And they're holding on to what made them successful in the past. It's the old adage, what got you here won't get you there. A lot of retailers and retail technology companies have not woken up yet. They think, you know, I was with a large retailer at one point, and they said to me, we've been around for, you know, tens of decades. Well, great, good for you. They're like, we've weathered storms before.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I was like, oh, I'm sorry. You think this is a storm, right? Well, that's fascinating because, like, storms end, right? Eventually they pass on by and you go back to your normal day. And I said to them at the end, I was like, I don't know what to say now, because if you believe this is a storm, you're already dead. Like, I can't help you, right? I think there's a lot of people still there. So I think that's, you know, the winners and losers.
You know who this sounds like, right? This echoes a lot of what Simon had to say yesterday.
I was going to say the same thing, yeah.
It's like the losers are the ones sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah.
If you're sitting on the sidelines and you're not willing to experiment and try new things, then you're going to watch everybody pass right by you.
Yeah, I think that's right, except it's maybe slightly, I would tweak that a little bit and say they're not on the sidelines. They're just over-investing in the past.
Sure.
It's right? Like they're in the game. They're just at the wrong end of the rink.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they keep investing in the stuff that used to work. Mm-hmm. Or maybe a different way. They're really focused on them. Right? They're really focused on my asset.
Yep.
Improve my website. Improve my store. And it's like, no one cares about you anymore. That's the change they failed to realize. Is, you know, 10 years ago, with the introduction of smartphones and stuff like that, the entire model of commerce flipped on its head. Since the beginning of human experience, commerce has been the same process. As a human, I went to the merchant, and I was able to buy whatever the merchant had. The merchant was in control of the entire thing, right? If they wanted to sell apples that day, it was apples. Whether I wanted an orange or not was irrelevant, right? They had apples, that's what you could buy. That, millions of years of commerce operated that way. 10 years ago, it all flipped. Mm-hmm. And it flipped to be completely consumer-driven. The merchant has no power in this game anymore, right? It's all the consumers that own everything. And so now, same model. I go to the store. If you have apples, that's fine. I'm just going to pull out my phone and find the 9,000 other apple sellers who also sell bananas because I really wanted a banana, and I'm never buying from you again because you clearly don't understand what I want. That's a really drastic change in a small amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine why it's so hard for some retailers to flip over to this new model. Is they legitimately can show you decades worth of success based on the previous model. They can show you thousands of years of retail theory and knowledge and facts that prove their model is right. The problem is like, that's true. But the rules don't apply anymore. So we just started a different game. So you're amazing at baseball. We started playing football. I don't know what to tell you, right? You can either learn to play football or keep playing baseball, but nobody's watching.
Nobody's watching.
Yeah, and so I have sympathy because by rights, they should look at you and say, this can't be true. The whole world cannot have changed that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd want to say you're right, but it did. And so either wake up and realize that, or just, it's a countdown until you are no longer relevant.
You know what I love and where you've gone with this conversation is you're very much talking about the customer. And I feel like, and maybe Victor, you'll echo my sentiment here, but and maybe this is the culture of Shopify, but you're one of the first people that we've spoken to that's very much, it's the customer now. The power's with the customer. The retailer no longer has the power. Mm-hmm. And I think we can sometimes get up as brands, as retailers, caught up in thinking in abstract terms about what this technology X can do for Y. It's all about empowering the customer, right?
It's all about the customer, right? Your technology means nothing if a customer doesn't care about it.
That's it.
Right? I mean, that's it. So if you don't understand what the customer wants, you can have all the tech in the world. You're going nowhere.
Right. That's exactly right.
And it seems like things are evolving so quickly that that's where a culture of experimentation benefits you.
Exactly right. So the consumers aren't exactly sure what they want yet. Mm-hmm. Because it's coming very quickly. It's like, I have a phone. And now I have a phone that does buying. And now I have a phone that does facial recognition. And now I have a phone that does augmented reality. And now I have a phone. And it's like the new wave comes quickly to a consumer. And so their demand for purchasing and the way they want to shop changes rapidly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why you can't have a static model as a retailer.
Yep.
You have to have nearly daily dynamic changes.
Right.
Because that's the consumer. The consumer is changing their behavior constantly. It's like, yesterday I wanted it like this, today I want it like that. Well, you can't be like, but yesterday, it's over. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter anymore. It was yesterday. I want it like this today.
Right.
Right? And they're getting faster. They're getting less tolerant of delay and time and frustration. Right? I mean, I can just watch, you know, forget it. We're all consumers. We all shop. What is your tolerance level today for a bad experience? Zero.
Yeah.
Right? You will leave in a heartbeat if you get to a site that's too slow, if you go into a retail location and the line at cash checkout is too long. I mean, you'll just walk away and you'll never come back. Yeah. We've been trained that it's our world. The consumers own the world. And we've learned that very, very quickly.
Yeah,
and so our tolerance for retailers who don't get it has gone to zero. And so if you're a retailer, this is a very dangerous time because you have one shot. Right? I mean, think about Black Friday, Cyber Monday as an example. How many retailers lost customers forever because their sites crashed or they didn't have the product? It's mind-boggling that we're still doing this.
Right.
It's like, it's a failure to recognize who's in charge. As a retailer, you are only here at the good grace of the consumer. The moment you violate that, they will destroy you. You can't survive without them. They don't need you anymore, right? It used to be we needed the merchants because we had no other way to get them. I don't need the merchant. I can sit right here on this podcast or buy whatever I want. So what do I need a retailer for?
Right.
Do you think this enables brands more than ever? Do you think this is the opportunity for...
Human beings love stories. They love stories. It's how we exist. The only reason humans exist today is because we managed to tell stories for generations.
Yeah.
And so we love emotional attachment. We love brands, right? We just do, because they're a story. So, there's an obsession with Amazon, but it's because of efficiency, not because we really love them. Hmm. If you really sit someone down and they'll be like, oh man, I love Amazon. Well, if you actually go deeper and say, do you love Amazon or do you love speed? They're like, oh, I love the speed. Well, if you could get the same speed from the brand you really like, would you shop? Yeah, I'd shop there. Of course you would, because you want the story. There's no story at Amazon, right? So brands have a huge advantage if they understand that that's what the customer wants from them. The customer wants to experience the brand. Mm-hmm. Humans want experiences, full stop. We want them online. We want them offline. We want them in social. We want them with our friends. We want them randomly. We want experiences. We're sitting at a show. This is an experience, mm-hmm. right? You can argue the quality of the experience, but it's an experience. And so, you know, brands have a much higher capacity to create a compelling experience than generic, you know, marketplaces.
Where do you think this lies for brands who are using brick and mortar retail as their primary channel for sales? Where does that...
Yeah. I mean, again, flip the question. What does a consumer want? I want to buy your product wherever I want to buy it. I don't care where you want to sell it. So now, as a brand, you have to try and figure out how to put your product, how to make your product available to the consumer in as many places as that consumer might be.
Yeah.
So if you stand there, I think it's actually a slight mis representation for a brand to be like, my strategy is bricks and mortar, then your strategy is flawed. Because bricks and mortar is a single channel. Now, it might be an important single channel. It might be your biggest single channel. But it is not your strategy. If that's true, where you're like, I bet the farm on bricks and mortar, you're dead man walking. It's just because for bricks and mortar are geographically limited, right? Actually, you have to be physically near one to use one, right? There's just, it's a bad single strategy. Should bricks and mortar be in your strategy? Sure. Now, let's define what bricks and mortar is. Do you mean long-term bricks and mortar? Do you mean pop-ups? Do you mean experiments? Do you mean, like, what do you mean by this?
Yeah.
And so my advice to all brands is stop looking at any one of them as a panacea to solve your problem. The consumer doesn't care about any one of them by itself. The consumer cares about themselves. So if at the moment I want to buy that pair of jeans, I happen to want to buy it in a store, I hope you have a store. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a store and you've never thought about a store, well, then that customer is probably not going to buy from you because they're going to go to the store they want to go to. So it's challenging because it presents what is now hundreds of potential channels to a merchant and says, you got to pick, right? That's really hard. So you got to really understand your customer. Where does your customer like to shop, right? And tune your model to that. So, you know, over the last couple of years, we've seen pop-ups just explode, right? Everyone's running pop-ups.
Yeah. Yep.
It makes perfect sense, right? Because it's user feedback. It's brands going, you know what we keep hearing? Why don't you have a store? So we gave them a store, except I don't want the overhead of a store, right? So we gave them a pop-up store, which was kind of like a store, but gave them an experience. It also showed our customers that we're listening, right? It tuned itself to what the customer asked for instead of saying, my strategy. Your strategy is not as relevant to the customer's need.
I've got another question for you, but I feel like it's gonna open up a whole world here. But what do you see? And I guess brick and mortar has been the dominant channel for so long for brands. What do you see as the new dominant channel, if there is a dominant channel? Which I think you're gonna say no. By the way, you're kind of shaking your head.
Well, I mean, it's been the dominant channel because there was no other option.
Yeah.
Merchants were in control. So bricks, a physical location is you could make the customer come to you,
mm-hmm.
right? So that was easy to distribute product and you could organize it and all that kind of stuff. I think dominant channel is highly dependent on brand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that simple. It's like, I don't know what the dominant channel is. You'd have to tell me what brand you're talking about.
Well, yeah. Let's
think about it, like a Rolex or something like that. Are you going to just buy that online, spur of the moment, impulse buy on
sure you are.
A social media website? Perhaps. Sure.
I mean, think about some of the, like Houdini and stuff like that. Massive luxury good retailers mm-hmm. online only.
Mm-hmm.
Selling $20,000 watches every day online. No one's ever touched.
Right.
So it depends. This is the challenge. Is you can't actually make blanket statements anymore.
It depends, yeah,
because definitely. There's an example of every single one of them that bucks all those trends.
Well, and ultimately, there's different consumers.
Some
consumers want to touch and feel. They want to talk to an associate. They want to learn about it, not by their own volition of going online researching.
Right.
They want to talk to a professional
right.
that might know something about it, hence where a pop-up shop makes a lot of sense, or a store that only has the items to show you, not to sell to you necessarily.
Right. And so this is the thing, is I think dominant channels become... brand and customer experience specific.
Yeah, right.
I don't think there's one or the other.
No, that's a completely reasonable answer. What I want to jump across to, and our audience is largely brands, I'm curious as to what Shopify Plus offers to brands who are kind of debating whether to build a solution or an e-commerce platform internally, as opposed to looking externally to get a platform such as Shopify Plus. What do you guys offer over the top of building internally?
I mean, my first comment is anyone that thinks that building their own e-com platform is a good idea is already dead.
Yeah.
Right? And I say that with as much respect as possible. You're not technology companies.
Yeah.
Stop trying to act like them. Right? It is hard enough to be a technology company building an e-commerce platform by itself.
Yeah.
I have 1,500 engineers. That's all they do. I cannot imagine being like a fashion company on top of that. And I think if you go back in history and you quietly, you know, by yourself in a room could get the original guys who did that, the Zappos and Bonobos and all those guys, and take them aside and say, would you do that again? They'd be like, hell no. I would never build my own platform ever again. It's extremely hard. It sounds easy. How hard can it be? I'll just build a cart and take checkouts. Okay, I hope you never get big.
Try it.
Right? Like, yeah, go ahead and try. Right? We've spent $1 billion trying to build one. Right? So, like, this is a lot harder than it seems on the surface. So my first advice is the days of building technology as a company are over. No one has the time for this. Whatever you think it's going to cost, it's going to be 10x that in actual cost.
Yeah.
Right? And are you a tech company or a retailer?
Right.
You're a retailer. I'm just going to, like, you are not a tech company. I don't care what you are not a tech company.
Or a brand.
Yeah.
Brand, retailer, same thing.
Whatever.
Right? Yeah, let's lump them. Brands. You're not tech companies. Right? I'm adamant about that point because, you know, it's hard to do both. Really hard. And so my question is, if you want to be a technology company, then get rid of the brand and be a technology company. So I think what we offer is scale, reliability, access to technology, partnerships, right? So if you look at Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat and Pinterest, all those channels were built by us, right? Like, mm-hmm. We're the partner. You're a brand? Like, no offense. Unless you're a giant brand that everyone knows, Instagram's not talking to you. They're not building you a connection to their stuff, right, with your one brand. That's not, so you're already out of the loop, right? So I think that, you know, we've spent a huge amount of effort and resources to build the best platform in the world. Try and compete with me, right? And the brand's on my platform. Like, good luck. I don't know what to tell you. Like, you can't, right? Not now. And so I think it's a bad business decision for people to try and build their own.
I'm curious. So I completely agree with you. And we hear it all the time, you know, from people that we talk to at Askewd. Oh, we're going to build our own solution. They're not a software company, but they're going to try to be. They have an IT team, and they assume that it means that we can do this. But what we're seeing now is companies like Walmart, and they're not the first ones to do this, open up incubators and try to, I guess, incubate these young companies that are technology companies that can move faster than a Walmart can. And then once they see something that's really stuck or something that's taken hold, they will then try to consume them, almost like acquiring them just like they would in the open market, and bring them into the Walmart family and create them as a division. What do you think about that idea? And this incubator in particular is called Store Number 8. So do you think that is something that can work, and do you believe in that, just to counter the point you were making?
Well, I mean, I think that without knowing the details of Store Number 8, right, who's actually in that? Tech firms building features that Walmart will use to sell product, or brands?
Right.
Right? If the answer is brands, none of them should be building their own tech. They should run it on Walmart's platform. Full stop. Right? If they're tech companies building features, there's rooms full of tech companies here building features. That's different. You're a tech company. You decided that. Right? I'm talking about, like, if you sell shirts, do not act like a technology company. Right? It's a bad idea.
Right.
Because you're going to have to choose at some point which one to spend money on, better shirts or better tech.
Right.
Right then, you're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
All I ever have to choose is better tech. I never have to choose better shirts. And the result is everyone that sells shirts on Shopify has the best tech in the world.
Right.
Right? They never have to make the choice.
Right. It's basically you can devote all your resources to doing one thing and doing it very well, just as they can do with their brand and everything they have to do to make consumers want their products.
And, you know, it's that. It's nimbleness. It's speed to market. It's, you know, new stuff. I mean, every time something gets released, yeah, as a tech firm, I can just focus on getting that up to date. As a shirt company, you got to choose. Do you spend money getting that new feature that everyone else has, right? Or do you make better shirts?
Definitely.
It sounds like an easy decision. So basically, you've sold me. If I'm ever going to start up a brand or anything, I think I will never try to build anything myself. Although I believe in completely everything that you're saying. I agree with you. It's a smart business decision to give.
I'll give you a tangible real world example of just how fast you can do something if you don't build your own tech. Now, we can argue why it works this way, and there's lots of advantages they had. But when Kylie Jenner decided to do lip gloss, right, they could have built their own. They could have said, hey, we're going to build our own e-commerce platform. Great. I have no idea how long that would take, but let's say they did that. They didn't. They came to Shopify, and they're like, we want to launch this thing. 18 months later, they were at $400 million in revenue.
Yeah.
you tell me if you can build a software platform in 18 months. So they said, you know what we'd rather do? Sell lipstick. Mm-hmm. You guys build the platform.
Right.
And then $400 million in 18 months. Yeah. Focus on what you're good at.
Right.
Not trying to be, like, I get it. Technology's sexy. VCs like to invest in technology. Don't kid yourself. Ask yourself a basic question. So to all your customers that are brands, sit down and ask a very basic question. If you had a dollar, do you want to spend it on servers or better products? Whatever you answer is what you are. Full stop.
Yeah.
And there's no way around it. There's no way to have both. Not anymore. We don't live in that world.
Right. And there's no good reason, if you think about it, to not invest in technology companies, because at the end of the day, the cost isn't different. If anything, it's more expensive to do it yourself.
It's way more expensive.
Yeah, but people, I think
you
there's
start a
fallacy.
Shopify store for $29 a month.
Right. Right. I think there's a fallacy though that people have that they can do it cheaper internally.
Yeah, it's impossible.
And I don't agree with it.
So I'm going to cut you both off. I think you've sold our sound man Max here as well. He looks like he's ready to buy a Shopify for his headphones and everything in here, but. We have run out of time, Lauren. I feel like we could talk for another hour, 2 hours or 3 hours or for the rest of the afternoon about this. And it's a really exciting topic, but I do want to thank you for coming in on short notice as well. Thank you, Victor, for taking part in the NRF as well. This is our last episode from the NRF. So we'll go back to our normal schedule after this. I'd like to thank everybody for listening and tuning into all the NRF shows. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Take care.